Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I have a very special guest with us on this episode. I have Matthew Scott. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there.
And some of you may know Matthew from things like Jersey Boys and An American in Paris, and my favorite, Sondheim on Sondheim, which featured an amazing all-star cast. I can't even imagine what that experience was like. Working was with Barbara Cook and Vanessa Williams and Norm Lewis and Ewan Morton. It's like an amazing lineup of talent. But you're here to talk about your brand new album, which is called The Jesus Year, A Letter from My Dad. But before we jump into, and I want to say first off that it's a wonderful album. But it's, as I constantly am hammering into the listeners, anytime you listen to an album, whether it's a cast recording or a vocalist recording, listen to it. Take the time to sit down and listen to it from beginning to end in one sitting, because the artist has put together a set list and a song list that's kind of taking you on a journey and telling a story. So it's important to listen to the whole thing. Now, having said that, I'm going to diverge a little bit from that because I am going to play a few samples from the album on the show, but that's just to give you a little bit of a taste as to what the album is about. And I then encourage you very, very much to get out there and listen to the album completely from beginning to end. So let's start with where you grew up and how you got into performing and singing.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for all of that. That's really lovely. I grew up in Bergen County, New Jersey. So just about a half an hour outside of New York City. Mm-hmm. And I'm the youngest of four boys, which I mentioned in the show. And I started coming into the city at a very early age. Music to me was somewhat second nature, I guess. And so I found my way to choir, and hanging out in the chorus room was kind of what I did during lunch when I was in school. I remember walking into the lunchroom once when I was about maybe 11 or 12 years old and being so overwhelmed by the noise. Mm-hmm. And probably what I now know, the anxiety, the social anxiety of it all. And I remember hitting it, and it was like walking into a wall. And I was so uncomfortable immediately. And I turned around and I started wandering the hall, and I didn't know where I was going. And there was an open door, and I heard music coming from it. And I recognized the song and the singer. It was Michael Feinstein, and it was one of his Gershwin albums. And the reason I recognize this is because my mom always played that music around the house. And so I ducked my head in and I saw the chorus teacher who was tidying up the room. And I said, "Can I sit here and eat my lunch?" He said, "Yes, of course." And I went into that room every day for the next 3 years.
Wow.
And yeah. And what eventually happened was, you know, on day three, he said, "You seem to know all these songs. Why don't you get up and sing a little bit?" And I did. And that was it. I started singing Gershwin and Cole Porter and Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer and Jerome Kern when I was like 11 and 12 years old. And so, you know, my parents were like, "Okay, this is interesting." and very early on, I said, because we were so close to the city, we just started coming in and seeing shows and seeing performers. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting thing for me to kind of express that, because I come from a very athletic family, three older brothers. Nobody in my family was a singer, you know, by trade or anything like that. So they were kind of like, "What is going on here?" But they recognized, you know, that I had a love for it and a talent for it. Mm-hmm. And both my parents nurtured it, like immediately nurtured it. So I just started singing when I was a kid, very early on.
The winter of 1995. I am 13 years old, and I am conquering the stage of my elementary school's auditorium, portraying the title role in the children's musical, Snoopy. The world, according to Snoopy, is big enough to go around. 3 billion people plus, that's the pop of, still we got room for sitting on top of. The world, according to Snoopy, can be the world you want it to. My whole family is here. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, my three big brothers, and of course my mother. They've had to listen to me singing this song from the top of my lungs for the past 2 months. So tonight, they are palpably relieved that this will be the final time. 3 billion people plus, that's the pop of. Still, we got room for sitting on top of. But someone is missing. Only a few months earlier, my dad had lost a year-long battle to cancer. But before he died, he knew I had gotten this part, and he was so proud. The world, according to Snoopy, is big enough to go around. 3 billion people plus, that's the pop of. Still, we got room for sitting on top of. Sitting on top of the world, according to Snoopy, can be the world you want it to. A beautiful thing to have on a string. The world he can bring to.
Then that led to, you know, sing at the PTA breakfast and sing at the this and that. And then the teacher there would go, my daughter's getting married. Would you sing at her wedding? And before I knew it, I had like a savings account when I was 12 and 13 and 14 years old, because I sang at weddings and I sang at anniversary parties and I sang in restaurants. And I kept learning music because, you know, if I sang at a restaurant every Saturday night when I was 16 years old, the same people come back to that restaurant every weekend, don't they? And so if you're singing for 3 hours, you got to learn more and more songs. And that's what I did. I just started learning songs and singing them. And that's how I got into it. And I think very early on, I realized two things. One, you could get paid to do it, which was crazy. And two, girls. They liked it. And that was very compelling argument for me. So I kept going.
That's too funny. I did not know any of that background about you. And it's very, because, you know, most kids that age, I remember I worked as a box boy at a grocery store in high school. And, you know, a lot of kids do the newspaper route, or they do you know, things like that. And here you are, basically, you're a semi-professional singer.
It was hilarious. It was a really weird thing to just fall into, but I kind of all of a sudden had gigs and regular you know, performances that I was doing. Like I said, I would sing at this restaurant, and it became just second nature to me and very normal to me. I don't know that I really anticipated it would become a career for me, because, you know, as a kid, somebody has to say to you, you know, you can do this. There are a lot of people who know who they are from a very young age, right? But I think I just thought it was something I would do, and that I would become a teacher, and, you know, music would be a part of my life and all that. And then when I got to high school, and I had a teacher who said, what are you doing? Like, why aren't you applying to colleges for this? And I said, well, is that a thing to do? He's like, yeah, you should be doing this. So I don't know the first thing about it. And he was very helpful. And he said to me, you know, there's a program called Carnegie Mellon. It's a great program. And it's in Pittsburgh. And I was like, Pittsburgh? That sounds terrible. And he said, well, you should apply. And I did. And I got in there. And that, of course, changed the trajectory of my whole life, because not only was it an incredible training for me, but I also met my wife there. And, you know, the whole course of my life changed. But up until that point, I don't think I ever thought that it would be something more than just, you know, singing in a restaurant on a Saturday night, or singing at an anniversary party or a wedding. I just assumed I would, you know, carry on and be something else. So that was a defining moment for me.
And then eventually that led you to New York and theater and shows. But let's talk about your memories of your dad before he passed, and then kind of talk about the letters, because, you know, when you read the story, it's one of those stories that you see depicted in movies or a novel or something, that's sort of, you know, this kind of this trope of, oh, you know, these discovered letters, But this really happened to you, which is even more amazing. I mean, it's even more amazing. So talk about your dad and how these letters came about.
I appreciate you saying to, you know, if you get a chance, listen to the album all the way through and listen to it in an order, because even though the story is not told linearly, mm-hmm. the album does build in that way. And so I appreciate you saying that. And it's also enjoyable to just pop out and listen to a tune here or there too. That was the idea, was to create it so it was enjoyable both ways. But my dad passed when I was 13. I was the mm-hmm. youngest of my three brothers with a 9-year age gap. So the oldest was 22 and in college. My mom and dad dated from the time they were 13. They were just kids. Mm-hmm. So this was, you know, a devastating blow. He was a really good dad. He was very present in our lives. He worked really hard, but still made all the time for us. And he coached our sports teams, and he was very supportive. And like I said, even when I became interested in theater early on, he saw that and nurtured it, even though he knew nothing about it, which I think mm-hmm. says a lot about him. And he passed in November when I was just 13 years old. That June, my mom decided to finally clean out the desk where he would work. And she came across these notes on a yellow legal pad. He was always writing on legal pads and things like that. And I'm the same way. There's just stuff all over the house where I write down my thoughts. And what we realized is that he had started writing to his sons, and it actually predated my birth. He started writing them in 1981. And then a year later, I was added to uh-huh. the list. And he wrote us notes. And basically the first lines of it are, "Hey, I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't know what prompted me to do this. And I don't know when I'm going to die." You know, it could be when you've had your third grandson. It could be before you've reached fourth grade. But I want to mm-hmm. write down some things that have occurred to me in my life. And he started writing down, and he separated the letter into sections: communication, sex, relationships, money, work, spirituality. And he just wrote his like musings down on paper. And we discovered it a year after. He never told anyone. I wonder if he'd forgotten. We don't know. You know, that's part of the mystery, mm-hmm. is if he had forgotten, or if he just kind of intended it to be like, you know, something that would sneak up on us one day after he was gone. And it was an amazing thing to be given. My mother gave it to us on Father's Day that year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like we were reunited with him after that time. And we carried that letter around, all of us, for a long time.
In June of 1996, my mother, she finally mustered up the courage to deal with some of my father's personal effects. And she came across a yellow legal pad. And on that pad, she noticed some writing, notes, written in a beautiful cursive. To Ryan, my beautiful first son. To Brendan, my beautiful second son. To Michael, my beautiful third son. To Matthew, my beautiful fourth son. It began. "Hi, guys. I have no idea as to why I'm doing what I'm doing right now. What prompted me? The Holy Spirit? I don't know. My ego? My love for you and your mother? The hope I hold for you? I don't know. All I know is that I'm doing it. I'm writing to you." Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? You're only dancing on this earth for a short while. And though your dreams may toss and turn you now, they will vanish away like your dad's best jeans. Denim blue, fading up to the sky. And though you want him to last forever, you know he never will. You know he never will. And the patches make the goodbye harder still. 25 bullet points, organized by category. Sex, communication, spirituality, relationships, work. He wrote, For whatever reason or however, I became motivated. I wish to share with you some of the things that have occurred to me in my life that have left impressions, suggestions, if you will, of the do's and don'ts of everyday life. Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? There'll never be a better chance to change your mind. And if you want this world to see a brighter day, will you carry these words of love with you? Will you ride the great white bird into heaven? And though you won't last forever, you know you never will. You know you never will. And the goodbye makes the journey harder still. I don't know when I'm going to die, he wrote. It might be when you've had your fourth child, or it may be before you've reached the third grade. But one thing's for sure, I will never get to teach you all that I dreamt of for you. Will you carry these words of love with you? Will you ride? Oh, 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 very young, what will you leave us this time?
Sometime later, there's a gap of about 20 years, which I'm not going to bore you with. But sometime later, I thought this is. I always thought it was just for me, and I never wanted to share it. And I got married to my college sweetheart, and at one point she said, "I'd like to see it," and I was like, "I'm not going to show it to you. That's not for you." But I acquiesced and I gave it to her. And she was a mess. And she said, this is you. You're him. This is amazing. I started to realize that there was so much good stuff in it. Mm-hmm. And that my dad, by nature, was an educator. And he talked to everyone on the street, strangers, anyone he met, he could hold a conversation. I thought, there's so much in here. I'm still healing and figuring out how to heal. What if this can help other people do the same?
Mm-hmm. So talk about the title, The Jesus Year, so that people understand what that is.
Well, I was poring over the letter one time. I was going through a really, really difficult time in my life. And I had started to have anxiety. I mentioned walking into that lunchroom at the age of 11. It wasn't until 20 something years later, I'm sitting in a therapist's office. And she's like, I think you have anxiety. I'd gone through this horrible period and I felt like I was dying. Like all these things were welling up in me. She said, Matt, I think you have anxiety. I was like, no, that's not a thing. You can't get that when you're 33 years old. And she's like, yeah, you can. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you have. And I said, okay. And so I started to deal with that. And it was tough. And I don't know why, but I stumbled across something about the Jesus year. I'm not deeply spiritual, but I was raised in, in a Catholic family. And even though my parents didn't hammer all that home to us, they were spiritual people who believed in treating people kindly and all of that good stuff. So, it's just about love and sharing that energy. So I stumbled across something about the Jesus year, which is a period of your life. It's a phenomenon in the 33rd year of life. When people go through a rebirth or an ego death or midlife crisis, and they learn something about themselves, or they begin to question what will happen, in their life if they don't make it. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. And sometime later, I'm sitting in Central Park, and because I'm still dealing with this on my own, and I'm reading the letter over and over, a letter that I've read thousands of times, probably. And I'm fixated on the date. I told you he wrote it, started writing it a year before I was born. And I'm like fixated on the date at the top of the letter. And I just can't get over it. And I start to do a little math. And I realize my father was 33 when he began writing this letter. And here I was at 33, sitting here pondering the same questions, going through some of the same things. And I mean, it shook me. I just like, mm-hmm. I just like froze and just started bawling because I could not believe the symmetry of life in mm-hmm. that moment. And he was going through the same thing. And that's what caused him to sit down and write it. And it was, you know, at that moment, I think that's when I was like, oh my God, not only is this content so wonderful, but this is the part of it that you're describing that feels like the movie, that feels like mm-hmm. that kind of cinematic moment where there's this revelation. And for me, it was, I thought, okay, so what do I do? You know, what's my next step? And I didn't have kids at this point either. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when I began writing the show, I think I really began writing it as a way to reconnect to him. And, when I started writing it 13 years ago, I mean, it's taken different forms. When I had my first son and I finally decided, you know, I'm going to put this up. I'm going to do this in a space. I'm going to throw it at the wall and just see what happens. I got my dream team to come to work with me, my friend Joe Calarco, brilliant director and writer, and my musical director, Vadim Feichner, who's also, they're both just incredible. And I knew they would challenge me in ways that I needed to be challenged because I had spent so much time in my head with this piece. And Joe said, this isn't about your dad anymore, you know, it's mm-hmm. about you becoming a dad and what you're going to leave behind for them. And that just kind of opened up, cracked the whole thing up in a very different way. And so, That really altered the direction of the piece and where we went with it.
And I want to talk a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about that because, you know, one of the things that I think comes across is as you said, not only it's the way the letters have affected you, not only as a grown man, but also as a performer, and mm-hmm. then eventually as a father. So it's sort mm-hmm. of like these kind of words of wisdom and direction and guidance from your deceased father have actually built you as a person, which has then touched every facet of your life.
Absolutely. In the middle of the letter, he kind of departs from the lessons a few times to just kind of create like little journal entries, I'll say. And he dates them and says, hey, I'm having a tough time at work today. And and the reason he probably wrote is because he wasn't talking about it. He probably wasn't telling my mom. Mm-hmm. He probably mm-hmm. didn't want to bring that home and burden anyone. I'm having a tough time at work today. And I'm scared. I don't know what's going to happen if I lose my job. I don't know what'll happen if I can't provide for my family that I love. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. then he would go on to say, and the reason I'm saying this to you is because sometimes you're going to feel like a failure at work and in life, and you, like me, are going to be scared. Like the vulnerability in that, you know, but also the universality in that statement. I mean, who has not felt that way at mm-hmm. some point, at many points in their life?
Right.
And, you know, to be able to say that to your kid, either in a letter or directly to them, it doesn't matter. To be able to say to them, hey, you've got this image of me. You have no idea how many times I sat up at night, racked mm-hmm. with panic and worry for you.
Right.
And that did inform me in so many ways. It informed my work and what really, you know, the times when I would struggle and have ups and downs and realize these, you know, the successes, the shows, the money that comes from it, that's not the thing to latch onto. Your people, your family, your friends, those are the things to latch onto. They're the only things that will sustain. And now, of course, that I have kids, mm-hmm. I look at them and I don't think anything else in the world matters. But I also know that my art makes me a better dad. And so I don't want, you know, it's not about letting that go entirely and just focusing on that thing. My doing what I do is important too, you know? And I know that some people are selfish. You have to leave town. You go to, you know, you leave town for 6 weeks, you go do a thing. Yeah. You know, and we figure it out mm-hmm. because I am in the business of raising empathetic human beings. My goal is to surround them with diversity and love and people who are passionate about what they do. And my God, I don't give a shit what they, oh, sorry, Dan. No, Donald, I don't care what they do.
You can use any language you want.
I don't care what they grow up to be in life, as long as they are passionate about it. And so if they see me doing that, don't you think that's the best thing I could do for them?
Right.
So it really has informed so much for me. I still listen to those words. And again, that's why I thought other people need to hear this. You know, there was a part of me that thought, is this selfish of me to turn this into something? This wasn't written to just me. It was also written to my brothers. And I talk mm-hmm. about my brothers in the show. I talk about the difficulty there and their, you know, their struggles and drugs and alcohol and all of that. And I talked to them and said, hey, this is going to be in there. And they were like, hey, look, it happened. So put it in. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But there was a part of me that thought, is this, you know, do I have the right to do this? And I think he would be proud, and I think he would be happy mm-hmm. that maybe other people can grow and heal from it too.
Exactly.
That's my hope.
I mean, exactly. Because you are taking what he has taught you and you're passing it on to others. Not only strangers who come to see your show, but also your own family, your kids.
That's right.
And that's right. That's kind of the major thing about this. And that's one of the things, one of the bullet points I have on my list, but it's a little bit later. But it's also the fact that the show itself, by you doing the show and ultimately the album, you're doing kind of the same thing for your kids that your father did for you. So it's not only it's not only the legacy of their grandfather, but it's also the legacy you're leaving your kids.
That is exactly what it is. And because I often thought, what would it look like if I were to write this letter to them? Like, mm-hmm. what would I write? And so much of what he said is so perfect. I thought, oh, well, this is how I'm going to do this. This is going to be the thing that endures. I remember walking through the park with my wife, Kirsten. Our second wasn't born yet, and he's only 7 months old right now, but he wasn't quite born yet. And I was still batting around the idea of this show and also making it into an album. And I said, you know, maybe it sounds selfish, maybe it sounds egotistical. I said, but, you know, one day I'm not going to be able to sing. I'd like for them to be able to remember what that sounded like, or, mm-hmm. Or if they never get to hear it, you know, who knows when something right. like that can be taken away from you. And so selfishly, I want them to have this. And you're absolutely right. This is my letter to them.
I hope you are also, you know, in your father's situation, he is writing all of this down on paper rather than actually talking to you directly about it, which is not unusual for, you know, men, husbands and fathers and men of that era. Right. You know, my dad was much the right. same way. But, you know, I would hope that you are a little bit more open with your kids and you're sharing it with them now rather than, you know, have them later. But it is wonderful for them to have this album because it's something that they can listen to forever.
Yeah.
They can pass it on to their kids. It's something it's a document of your family history.
I mean, no one will have a CD player in 20 years, but yes. And, right. It's so true. The thing is, you know, because I was so young when he passed, we really did have lots of conversations about things. But I think my older brothers got him at a very different time, a different right. prime time, where a lot of the heavier, more important life lessons when they were turning a certain age, like he was, and I just didn't get to that point. You know, I joke in the show, I say, I never got the whole birds and the bees speech, and I didn't, you know, so I learned a lot. You know, I looked at the letter and I also just, I was kind of flying blind on certain aspects that I know if he were around longer, he probably would have, you know, been able to impart that wisdom. But it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. This will be there for my kids and hopefully for their kids.
So talk about when you were putting the show together, how did you pick the songs? Where did the songs come from? Because they're obviously, not only is it your, you know, the memories and the content of the letters are a huge part of the show, but you very smartly woven in a variety of songs from all different genres to kind of fill this out. And and how did you decide what songs you were going to use?
So, you know, you mentioned Barbara Cook and being on stage with Barbara Cook and Sondheim. That was obviously a highlight of my life in many ways. But I was a weirdo when I was 13, 14 years old. I was coming into New York City and going to the Cafe Carlyle.
Oh my God, really?
The Oak Room at the Algonquin and Rainbow and Stars. And I was listening to people like Rosemary Clooney and Andrea Marcovici and Bobby Short and Barbara Cook. And so cabaret was always my first kind of foray into this. I loved it. And I was always the youngest kid in the audience. People looked at me, they would say, I mean, Andrea Mercovici got so used to me being there year after year that eventually she would invite me to sing, and I would come back on a Tuesday night and I'd get up and I'd sing a song, and she'd sit at the piano and like stare up at me, and I'm 16 years old. And I was weird. You know, my whole thing about cabaret was I was never interested in, oh, it's an evening of Cole Porter. Oh, it's an evening of Johnny Mercer. Yes, of course, love those writers, but if there wasn't a story, and if there wasn't a narrative, and if the song didn't propel into the next moment, I found it to be kind of like pointless. So when I was in Sondheim on Sondheim, I was approached by a couple of people who said, hey, we could book you into this club and this club and this club. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I don't have anything to say. And they were like, no, just throw it, and literally said, just throw together an evening of Cole Porter. And I was like, that is the last thing I want to do. And so
that makes for a very bad cabaret show.
Yeah. And so I said, and I probably could have done it, but I said, I'm good. And then shortly thereafter, this idea was hatched. And I thought, oh, I know what to do. You know, I'm a guy who studied theater. I know that a song needs to propel a story. It needs to not just stand still, like some of the old musicals, which we all love, you know, the plot would stop so the two people could sing to each other, right? And then it would resume after the song was over. Nothing wrong with that. Some of the most glorious songs ever written, but that was the device. I thought, if I'm going to tell a story in an hour, it's going to keep moving the whole way through. And so that was number one. I'm also, you know, a person of the theater, right? So all the theater songs are at your fingertips. And my God, they're story songs, aren't they? They're written from the point of view of a character who wants or needs something. I had a really tough time putting theatrical songs. There are only a few in the show, you'll note, and they're all by Bill Finn. and one of them is from his song Cycles Elegies. I had a tough time putting theater pieces into the show because I didn't want to associate with a character in a play. But I grew up, aside from listening to musicals, and I grew up listening to all the people featured on this album. Harry Chapin, Cat Stevens, Billy Joel, Paul McCartney, Ben Folds. Because these guys are storytellers.
Exactly. And that's what I was just going to say.
They write stories that advance.
They write songs that are kind of universal truths in the sense that anybody can listen to them and feel them.
And feel.
And relate to them. Poet.
They're real poets. So I knew that if I found the right tunes there, I would be able to interpret them my own way and still kind of divorce myself from any original performance of them. And then, you know, the show underwent so many versions. I used to have a 12-minute Joe Cocker medley in the middle of it because my dad and I used to love listening to Joe Cocker. And I think Joe Cocker is one of the greatest of all time. People are like, are you serious? You're a Broadway Joe Cocker? I'm like, yeah, he's the best. But I took that out because it didn't advance the story. But in my mind, I thought, okay, what would have been a song playing on the radio at the time I was growing up that, you know, when I'm trapped in the car with my dad for those 2 hours and he's driving me and I have no idea where we're going. Like, what were we listening to? Well, we were listening to, you know, a bunch of songs by guys with guitars. And okay, well, what would have been a song that would have been playing when my mom and dad started dating when they were kids? And that's why I sing Our Day Will Come. And then I think, well, what's a song that I would have put on a mixtape to impress a girl? You know, my wife. And that's, you know, You're My Home. That's Billy Joel. And so that's how the album was built. And slowly I just started, you know, deciding what those songs were. When the kids came along, a couple of more were added to the mix. One, namely Paul McCartney, Calico Skies, because it was literally one of the songs playing as my first child was born. You know, it was written that I would love you. From the moment I opened my eyes and the morning when I first met you gave me life under calico skies.
It was written that I would love you from the moment I opened my eyes and the morning when I first saw you gave me life under calico skies. I will hold you for as long as you like. I'll hold you for the rest of my life. Always looking for ways to love you, never failing to fight at your side, while the angels of love protect us from the innermost secrets we hide. I'll hold you for as long as you like. I'll hold you for the rest of my life. Long live all of us crazy soldiers who were born under calico skies. May we never be called to handle all the weapons of war we despise. I'll hold you for as long as you like. I'll hold you for the rest of my life. I'll hold you for as long as you like. I love you for the rest of my, for the rest of my life. It was written that I would love you.
And the idea that it was written that I would love you, mirroring the whole idea of these letters, and those being the last words of the show that I sing proper. And then the encore, you know, the first version of the show that I did was only 2 weeks after Stephen Sondheim passed away. So I had no Sondheim in the show. And the very first time I did it, I sat down at the piano and I played Nothing's Gonna Harm You, because I thought that that was kind of befitting. But on the album, you'll notice we do Children Will Listen. Mm-hmm. And that's really the only truly theatrical song on the album, because it also speaks to,
right, you
know, to the piece. So yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about what those pieces would be, and I'm really satisfied with where we landed. And you know, as long as people can listen to it independently, you know, decide, hey, I'm mm-hmm. going to listen to Someone's Always Cooler Than You, Ben Folds, you mm-hmm. know, and feel like that's its own event. But if they listen to the track before it, where I talk about right. the Jesus year and my dealing with anxiety, and mm-hmm. then listen to There's Always Someone Cooler Than You, they get the full effect of why that song is there.
My dad started writing this letter over 40 years ago. Started it when he was just 33 years old. The 33rd year of life is commonly referred to as the Jesus year. It might be a time when you are reborn in some sense. Maybe you experience a midlife crisis or an ego death. Perhaps it's a year when you abandon your old ways and start new. For my dad, he had this sinking suspicion that he would not be around to watch his children grow, and so he began writing this letter so that we might carry his words with us after he was gone. For me, I spent my 33rd year of life on Xanax. Smile like you got nothing to prove. No matter what you might do, there's always someone out there cooler than you. I know it's hard to believe, but there are people you meet. They're into something that is too big to be expressed through their clothes. And they'll put up with all the poses you throw, and you won't even know that they're not sizing you up. They know your mom fucked you up, or maybe let you watch too much TV. But they'll still look in your eyes to find the human inside. You know there's always something in there to see beneath the veneer. Not everybody made the list this year. Have a beer. cooler than you. There's always someone cooler than you. Now that I've got the disease, in a way I'm relieved, 'cause I don't have to stress about it like you do. I might just get up and dance, or buy some acid wash pants, when you don't care that you got nothing to lose. And I won't hesitate, 'cause every moment life is slipping away. Cooler than you. There's always someone cooler than you. There's always someone cooler. Life is wonderful. Life is beautiful. We're all children of one big universe. So you don't have to be a chump. Every moment life is slipping away. It's okay. Make me feel tiny if it makes you feel tall, but there's always someone cooler than you. Yeah, you're the shit, but you won't be it for long. No, there's always someone cooler than you. There's always someone cooler than you. There's always someone cooler.
And that's why I'm always pushing people to listen from start to finish, please. Even if it's even if it's not an album that contains dialogue like this one does, the artist takes time to come up with a song list, and the running order of the songs is important. So, you know, give it a listen. But talk about the shift from turning this show, a one-man show, into an album, because it's not as easy as everybody thinks. Putting an album together is a totally different logistical nightmare. It's the technology. It's all of that. So making the decision to turn this into an album, where did that come from? And then talk about the actual process of getting the album made.
Well, yeah, it's a pretty wild story, actually. So pre-pandemic, that's how we're going to delineate from here on out. Pre-pandemic, I was approached by Tommy Krasker and Philip Chaffin, who own and run PS Classics, the record label that produced this album. The reason I know Tommy and Philip is they recorded Sondheim on Sondheim, along with hundreds of other major cast albums. They're a multi-Grammy nominated label. And I also did a handful of novelty albums for them. I did a beautiful album of Jerome Kern music, called The Land Where the Good Songs Go, which was a song cycle orchestrated and arranged by my really good pal David Loud, a brilliant musical director on Broadway. And that album is me and Rebecca Luker and Heidi Blickenstaff and Colin Donnell. It's just a gorgeous album. And we did a Cole Porter album as well. And so pre-pandemic, Tommy reached out to me and he said, "Hey, Philip and I have always loved working with you, and we only do a couple of projects a year. Would you want to make your own album?" And I was kind of stunned. And I said, "Yes, of course, of course." And we began talking about what that might look like. And we had a couple of ideas. And here I am, ready. I said, "Well, what if I do an album of Johnny Mercer?" I'm doing the exact same thing I said I didn't want to do.
Right.
But I love Johnny Mercer. He's one of my favorite writers of all time. And you know, I knew I could make a cool album and something I'd be proud of. And even then, Tommy was like, "I think that's your second album. I don't think that's your introduction." I said, "Okay, well, what do we do? What do we do?" And I began working on an album with my friend David Loud. And we began putting together a bunch of tunes. And it felt like it could have been really lovely and special. But it felt like work Do you know, it felt like, well, what's next? What should happen now? It felt like we were trying to create something out of thin air. Well, then, you know, the world hits the giant pause button and everything falls away. And we all retreat to our, you know, houses in the mountains, or, you know, people are moving back in with their parents in Ohio. And hundreds of people in my industry are leaving the business because what they're learning is, oh, I can't afford to live in this city. Why did I ever convince myself I could be successful? And my wife and I, you know, I had just closed a Broadway show called Grand Horizons, which is a play that was always a limited run. And my wife was starring the show off Broadway called Rock of Ages. And everything shut down. And we said, well, let's hop in the car and let's drive into the mountains and stay with our family for a week. 10 months later, we were pregnant.
Right.
and I thought, okay, this is really wild. And we had our first child, Desi. And everything just changed. The whole world changed for me. As I said, I had written a version of the show once before, and I had done a version of the show, but it was before I became a dad, and it was different. It had a 12-minute Joe Cocker medley smack in the middle of it. And somewhere in the middle of it, I started to realize that I need to revisit it. And so I reached out to a friend of mine named Don Hartley, who runs the Kauffman Center on West 67th Street, where I've done hundreds of concerts. And I said, Sean, I've got a script, You know, could I do this one night? He said, this is so beautiful. Yes, please come and do it. And I did. And so I put it up in front of an audience. I would say about 90% of it is what you hear on the album. And just by happenstance, someone recorded it. And I sent it to Tommy Krasker. And I said, hey, I just did this. Thought you might be interested. And he wrote me back and said, I cried through the whole thing. I laughed through the whole thing. And then I listened to it three more times. This is your album. What are we doing? This is your album. And I kind of in the back of my mind knew that he was right and maybe had hoped that he would say that, but I didn't think it would truly be. He said, we got to do this. Well, you know, another year and a half went by. As you pointed out, these things are not easy to throw together, and they're expensive and they're time consuming and they often stall, and you often discover that, you know, the money's not there. Needless to say, we were coming upon a deadline of sorts. Said, we're getting this done. We're getting this done. And God bless him, he did. He pulled it together. And we got in the studio and we made it. And I still, to this day, can't believe it actually got done. And that it sounds the way it does, because I'm really proud of it. We had it was just originally me and my musical director, Vadim Feichner, on the keys. Vadim is the original musical director of Spelling Bee and the Falsettos Revival. He's a brilliant musician. But we knew we had to beef it out. And so a guy named John Baxendine added full orchestrations to it. And it sounds so beautiful. It's it's beyond anything I ever envisioned for it.
Yeah. Well, when you put yourself in the hands of Tommy and Philip, who I've known for ages, what I love about them and what they do with PS Classics is they have, they've, especially in the last several years, since Tommy's not working as much as he used to, they are always looking for quality over quantity.
Yes.
And they work on a couple of things a year, and their goal is to produce the absolute best. Yeah. They have the most, they have like the most curated lineup of albums and of any of the ones
really
in the business. You know, and everything
really
they release
special.
Is special. Yeah. And
it
I, and when I, when I saw this one, the first thing I thought of, and I'm not, don't want to like divert people's attention to another artist, but I'm sure you listened to Jeff Harner's Sondheim album, which is just a gorgeous album. I mean, he just, it's the same. I mean, he is basically, it's so personal and so intimate about himself using the lyrics of Stephen Sondheim to tell his story. And I felt sort of like this is almost like a companion piece in some ways, because it's another artist who's telling their story, and through songs and dialogue and under the guidance in the studio of Tommy Krasker, who's like one of the best producers in the business. He just is.
He really is. That's a lovely thing to say. Any comparison to Jeff, I'll take. I think he's a master. Yeah, I think I think that you're absolutely right. I think that's what felt so special when Tommy said, we want to do this. You know, the mm-hmm. album that they released before me was, you know, Victoria Clark's singing right. Maura Yeston's December songs.
December songs, pieces. Right.
And I'm like, wait, you want to do my little thing next? I have to give Tommy credit at every turn. He's the best. And he hears things that nobody hears. And he understands things that nobody understands. And he would always call me and say, hey, I have a thought and I don't want to. And I was like, Tommy, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I obviously am going to listen to what you say. You're obviously right. You know what I mean? And he always was. But it really was a true collaboration. And you know, mm-hmm. going back to that conversation pre-pandemic where he said, we have always enjoyed being in the studio with you. We want to do this with you because we think you're a special artist. And, you know, he just kind of puts you in a place where he assures you that he's going to take care of it. And I never once doubted. There were times I doubted that it would get just because of the nature of the business and the world, but I never doubted when we were actually doing it, that he wasn't going to make a great product. And I think as an artist, and this is what I've learned in my life, and a lot of this is also from my dad, things that he said, you have to trust people. You mm-hmm. have to be so good at what you do that you can let other people take the reins. Isn't that interesting? Just to know that, you know, you can be at the top of your field and you still have to be able to collaborate and work and listen with people. And that's why my director, Joe Calarco, and my musical director, Vadim Feichner, and Tommy were the perfect partners on this, because there were times they'd look at me and go, Matt, it's this, it's not that. And I would go, okay. Mm-hmm. Or I would go, well, hold on. Let me talk this through. What if I did this? What if I did that? Sure, go ahead. Go home, rewrite that. I'd hand it back in the next day. Yeah, it's still this. I go, all right, you're right. You know? And you just have to trust mm-hmm. the people who know.
Right.
Because I was so close to this story and so close to this piece for so many years, I knew I needed that guidance and that guiding hand, because I knew there were people on the outside who were saying, this is what we see in here. This mm-hmm. is what you think it is. This is what it is. Mm-hmm. So to, you know, just to give Tommy all the credit, he took this thing and really lifted it. And I'm just delighted with the way it came out.
Picture postcard, a folded stub, a program from the play. File away the photographs of your holiday and your mementos may turn to dust, but that's the price you pay for every year is a souvenir that slowly fades away. A souvenir that slowly fades away.
So the album is now out, and I'm assuming you've been getting feedback.
Yeah,
I'm assuming it's been overwhelmingly positive, because it's just a wonderful listening experience.
Thank you so much. I'm getting some beautiful, really like lovely personal notes from people who have listened to it like a dozen times. And, you know, we're a week out from Father's Day here. And mm-hmm. I kind of think it's like the ideal Father's Day album. I really do. Because I know, you know, on the surface, think, oh God, the Jesus year, is this going to be a very preachy album? No, it's not. Oh, well, it's about a kid who lost his dad. Is it going to be very maudlin? No, it's not. You know, mm-hmm. the one thing my dad never would have wanted is for me to take myself seriously, you know, and there's a lot of humor and there's a lot of laughter because he was funny. And it doesn't really reach that place. It certainly gets emotional. But there's a lot of just looking at life sideways or head on, frankly, mm-hmm. and laughing, looking and laughing,
right.
and kind of celebrating it. There's a lot of joy in it.
And I, to be honest with you, after I listened to it, I had a friend of mine who recently lost, it was a kind of a mutual friend, and she lost her best friend to cancer just a couple of months ago. And they used to do everything together. And I recommended this album to her because one of the things I have been telling her, having lost close friends myself and lost both my parents, I have told her, you know, the grieving process. But at the end, when you come out, when you get to the end of that tunnel of grief, you're left with the happy stuff, the great memories, the wise things that they've, you know, passed on to you. And that's kind of what this album does. And it not only is it a wonderful thing for people who, for their memory, or to remember their fathers, or just for Father's Day, or, you know, fathers and sons or fathers and families to share. It's also a wonderful album to listen to if you have lost someone. It doesn't have to be your father. It's just losing someone and understanding what they leave behind and how to look at the positive side of it and gain something from it. And I thought that's really what the album gave me when I listened to it. And I immediately recommended it to my friend and said, you need to listen to this because this is shows you what the end of the tunnel after the grief is. It really is.
It makes me so happy to hear, and I'm thank you for that. That's the highest kind of compliment you could get.
What's next? When is the Johnny Mercer album coming out?
Yeah, let's talk. I'm still all for it. Get me that 40 piece orchestra that Vicky Clark had.
Right, exactly. but you know, here's the deal: if you're going to do a composer album, that's fine, but that means that the liner notes have to be your liner notes because they have to give. That's one of the things that I always stress when I go to cabaret shows and somebody does do an evening of Cole Porter or an evening of a composer or even just an evening of a certain era. And my feeling is the show doesn't work unless the patter in between songs links the songs to you because people are there to see you and they want to understand why you're singing these songs. They don't want to hear you. They want to hear you sing the songs. But they want to know why you're singing the songs. So do a Johnny Mercer album, but make sure your liner notes explain it.
Well, listen, and you know, I wrote my own liner notes for this album, which because I, even though the show explains itself, I wanted to give a context beyond that. That is the truth. And I think that that's what I was saying when I would sit in the audience and watch someone like Barbara Cook or Andrea Mercovici or Rosemary Clooney at the age of 80 something, you know, I'm like the heartbreak and the pathos and the storytelling in these 3.5 minutes. And then you switch gears and you come over here and you tell a funny story and then you sing this song. You know, the thing about Johnny Mercer for me is because I just always felt like lyric wise, I always just locked into his lyrics. I just thought, you know, he wrote, and of course he didn't always write lyrics. He wrote with other people as well, but I just always kind of connected to him as an artist and thought that his words were honest and true and that I could do exactly what you're saying. I could make them mine. And I think that's that's the work of a truly great artist, right? Of course they're writing it on their voice there. And Mercer was a singer. He was a very good singer, you know, they're writing it for themselves naturally because they're sitting at the piano and they're the first voice that hears it. But when others can take it and run with it, well, there you go. I mean, that's somebody who's truly, truly great. So the next thing, I'll tell you what, I have no idea. I think I'd like to write something for someone else. Because there were so many times, and I do direct people's shows, and I enjoyed that very much because there are so many times when I was writing this piece and I found myself so trapped in the center of it that I felt like I lost perspective and I didn't know where to go. There were a couple of times when I was working on it where I thought, I should have somebody else do this, perform it. Like I should call, I don't know, Drew Gehling or Gavin Creel. Somebody should come and sing this and do it. And I'll just sit back and watch because I don't know that I have the perspective to be in it at the same time. And that's why you hire the people who are going to, you know, help you along the way. But no, I think the next thing I'd love to do is write something for somebody else, just continue to work on other people's pieces and build another show. Of course, it's not going to have as a unique a story as this. This is kind of a once in a lifetime thing that you kind of generate. But, you know, I'm 41. So who knows what's next? Who knows what'll happen next year that I'll write about?
That's right. And as Tommy told you, this is the perfect first album because it introduces you to the audience. You know, they may have heard you on, you know, a Cole Porter album. They have heard you on Sondheim on Sondheim, but now they're hearing you, the person. Yeah. And that's what the album does. And that makes them know you, you know? And so whatever you do next, they're going to be interested because they feel like they know who you are. And that's what's important. That's what's important about this album is it really does. It's very exposing. I mean, it's certainly a very exposing show and an exposing album. But that's what makes the kind of artist that people love to follow because they know that someone who puts it all out there and kind of feels very vulnerable is someone they want to know. So
I appreciate that. And I'm thank you for saying as much, truly.
So thank you, Matthew, for taking the time today.
Thank you.
To chat. We're now out of time. Hopefully we'll have you back sometime soon.
That'd be great.
And we can chat again. Where do you want people to find you online?
Yeah, I'm on the Instagram, and that's always the best way to do it. I share a lot of content about performances and my very, very cute children. it's the only reason to follow me on social media, truly.
Do you have an actual website where people can also find you?
We're in the process of doing that now. I had one years ago.
But I will send people to PS Classics.
Yeah.
PS Classics will have a website.
PS Classics, we're up there, and I think we're on the splash page there. But we're in the process of building a site. I had one years ago, and they kind of became passé at the time I had one. And I thought, well, this is foolish, and now everyone has one again.
Right.
So I need another one. Yeah.
Well, thank you again. It's been an absolute treat chatting with you.
Thanks, Donald. Likewise, I really appreciate it.